History happened everywhere.
The verdict.
This is our after-show podcast where we look back at the most recent episode, Mindfulness, in the Duneverse during 200 BG to 10,191 AG. So if you haven't listened to that, go back and check it out, or else there's going to be spoilers ahead.
Yay! I've created a new thing. We've never had that before. I've made history. I'll take that.
Hello, my name is Ryan Weir, and I am here in the HHE studio with the spicy sausage to my slimy worm. It's Mr. Peter Goddard.
Your intros are becoming more weirdly sexual adjacent with every passing week, and I don't like it.
It's in the eye of the beholder, Pete. And we are joined, as ever, by the dynastic despot of Dune. It's the imperial judge of the change. It's Mr. Paul Dursley.
Oh, God, here we go.
Now, Peter, I have spent the past week being digested by a 400-meter-long sandworm. And as such, I've completely forgotten everything that you talked about in the last episode. So would you mind reminding me what happened in, I don't know, let's say 60 seconds?
Well, that will happen with the worms, but when would you like me to start?
I would like you to start now.
I took us to the Duneverse, the distant, far-flung future of our own universe, where spice is life and the sand gets everywhere. And watch out for the worms. We learned about how artificial intelligence has developed, taken over the universe, and was then destroyed again during the Butlerian Jihad, and the eerie parallels with the dangers of AI today. We met the Mentats, humans with the processing power of computers and personalities to match, and we discovered the remarkable feats of processing people can perform nowadays. And we met the Bene Gesserit space nun witch women, with their human-oriented powers of intuition and their own use of mindfulness meditation. Practices that, even today, evidence suggests might be one way to deal with your pain. It was Mindfulness in the Duneverse between 200 BG to 10191 AG.
That was last week's episode done, summarised nicely, nice one, son. Now we're over to a young Dursley who's gonna tell you what he thought of the. He'll take you apart without any care. He's the lovely Paul Dursley. The lovely Paul Dursley.
Ah, yes, I remember now, and what an episode it was, Peter. You took all of us around the galaxy, and indeed the Duneverse, to learn a lot more about mindfulness, and I loved it. I learned an awful lot about Dune, but it really matters not what I think. We are here for the opinion of just one man, Judge Dursley. So, Paul, before we reach the final verdict, why don't you tell us your first impressions of episode 86?
I refer you to the answer I gave at the end of the last episode.
Yeah, it was an E, wasn't it?
Yes, it has to be said. I have low expectations of this judging. We know that Paul hates fiction, and this is entirely fictional, so I have settled into my terrible grode.
I don't hate fiction. I don't like this soft science fiction.
Now, you have said this before, haven't you? You don't mind it when it's sort of like real science fiction.
Yes, as if it's plausible.
As opposed to a 400-meter-long sandworm racing through the dunes of a desert planet.
Well, yeah, but that in itself is a function of the size of the planet. The planet must be pretty big, then, if it can take creatures of that size.
But I'm glad that we started talking about sandworms, because, well, how on earth do they move at speed? Because, to my knowledge, worms are pretty slow-going creatures at the best of times.
Yeah, there's not a saying as fast as the worm, is there?
Yeah, so I looked it up, and, well, the books don't really describe how the sandworms move through the sand.
Soft science fiction.
Yes, well, that's exactly. But I was interested in the physics, Paul, and I thought that might lure you out into helping me out with this.
Well, you're talking about the way that snakes move by slithering across in an S pattern.
Yeah, they sort of push the sand behind them and that will move them forward as they go. But we don't see the sandworms moving in that way. They move in like a straight line, like almost like a train across the desert. And I was thinking, well, that's not like a worm either. Worms sort of go up and down, don't they, rather than side to side. So the only answer in physics that can explain this is that they are inhaling lots of sand as they move and then pooping it out, thus propelling themselves like a rocket forward through the sand.
It's a jet worm.
Come on, Paul, you're a physics man. Is my sand poop propulsion system a goer?
Well, I suppose if you think about the Vasiliev rocket equation.
I do.
I think of little else.
Then sort of the thrust coming out of its backside must be greater than the friction over moving over the sand, which would be very high.
Right.
Given that sand is a very rough or a notoriously rough surface. And the energy of the outgoing sand would have to be bigger than the energy of the incoming sand, plus the mass of the creature. So it must add energy into the outflowing stream of sand, because you've got to equate the energy. So if it's just the sand in and the sand out, and it adds no more energy to it, then it can't actually move at all. So it's having to add to the kinetic energy of the sand coming out. So that has to come from its food.
So a question for you then, Paul. What is more important on a sandworm? Is it the front part, which sucks in the sand, or is it the back part of the worm, which propels it out?
Well, it's a very inefficient way of doing it, isn't it? If you've got a 400-foot long worm, this sand has got to pass through 400 feet before it comes out the other end. Think of an aeroplane. The engines aren't the length of the plane. They're really quite small, because it's much more efficient to get it moving fast over a shorter distance.
Very true.
So really everything about this has not been thought through, and it's very, very soft science fiction.
So I get your point about airplanes with the engines being quite small and condensed. However, we're talking about a digestive system here, and I know from my own experience that I have explosive protrusions through my rear that don't rocket through my system. They sit there and then gradually build up. So perhaps it's eating sand.
I sometimes have those exactly the opposite.
I don't know what exactly the opposite is.
No, a sort of effluvia, a flux.
How wonderful. And that, everyone, is physics.
So, Ryan, I'm not going to confess to an error, but I found some contradictory information online. So
sounds like an error.
Not an error.
I couldn't give a toss if it's an error or not.
It's definitely not, because this was about some of the reality. So you remember I talked about the guy who recited pi to, I think it was 70,000 places.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I was then intrigued. I was looking into memory a bit more generally. So I looked into eidetic memory, and eidetic memory is a thing known more commonly as photographic memory, although it's slightly different, because photographic memory is images, whereas eidetic is remembering everything at a glance, essentially. So anyway, I was looking for examples of people who were considered to have an eidetic memory. Mm-hmm. And one of them came up as a guy called Akira Haraguchi, a retired Japanese engineer, who I discovered is the current holder of the world record of over 100,000 digits of pi, which took him 16 hours to recite. And that's different to the guy I said who was the current world record holder, Rajveer Meena, who only did a mere 70,000 over, I think it was 10 hours. But the reason this is not an error is that for some reason, and I couldn't get why, but Akira Haraguchi's record is unofficial, whereas Rajveer Meena is the official record holder. So this also begs the question why someone spent 16 hours reciting pi without a Guinness person in the room, or whatever technicality meant it wasn't really a world record.
I know a fact. I know how many possible bridge hands there are.
Okay. Bridges in the card game?
Yes.
How many?
It's 2235-197-406-895-368-368-301-55999.
Oh, wow. I thought there was another number coming.
Well, I was waiting for another 15 and a half hours, to be honest.
Although, I may have said this before, I quite often listen to audiobooks, and I listened to one by Douglas Coupland a while ago. Mm-hmm. And in this book, they recite pi to a number of thousand decimal places, and the poor narrator had to do it
in the audiobook. Oh, that's not a good day in the recording studio, is it?
It was complete and unabridged.
Wow.
But anyway, back to eidetic memory. There's another one, a guy called Charles Nalda Byerts, who was a publisher in New Zealand, who claimed he learnt Maori by memorising a dictionary. And apparently his favourite party trick was to just read a newspaper and just recite it backwards straight away.
Wow.
But what's interesting is eidetic memory is supposed to be without the use of mnemonic aids, so memory aids and stuff. So we know that the Pi people use memory palace and other type memory tricks to help. So they're not really eidetic memory. And in fact, eidetic memory is quite controversial. So a lot of people think it doesn't exist. And apparently in 1970, a guy called Charles Strohmeyer studied a woman who had claimed that she could remember poems that she'd read in a foreign language that she didn't understand. And years later, she could recite the poem even though she didn't understand it at all. And he performed some memory tests on her and she passed the tests. However, some claim that the methods used in the testing were fairly questionable, and also those tests were never repeated. The subject, the woman, refused further examination. And to raise your sceptical eyebrows a little bit more, Strohmeyer, the researcher, then went on and married the woman who claimed to have the great memory.
Okay.
So, by and large, I think many people think that eidetic memory is not actually a thing that exists, and it's... there are tricks and talents and obviously people with great memory, but this notion of someone who just remembers everything, there is that yet to be, as I understand it, comprehensive evidence that that is an actual thing.
Wow.
Is it possible to remember everything, though? Is the theoretical maximum capacity of storage of the brain enough?
I think it's 9 pints, isn't it?
So we talked about sandworms, but we didn't really talk about any other creatures of the Duneverse, Peter. There were no robots, and we talked about the different types of people, but we didn't talk about the other kind of animal species that live in this world.
We did not. The brief was mindfulness, and I stuck to the brief.
Yeah, and so I just sort of fell upon some research, and I came across something rather strange and unique, and so I thought I'd bring it to the verdict. So in the 1984 novel Heretics of Dune, Frank Herbert introduces a bizarre concept called a chair dog. Now, despite the name, these aren't actually dogs. They are instead an organism which has been bioengineered to be a living piece of furniture. In this case, a chair. So basically what they do is they use these sort of technological advancements to create an organic being which is bred into the shape of a chair and then trained to offer massages to those that sit within them.
This feels like Douglas Adams may have been involved.
Or David Lynch would have been more suited to this. Yeah. They intelligently conform themselves to the shape of an individual and provide comfort in real time. So if you need a massage, it'll just do that. You'll just know because it senses it and starts to massage you. It's this sort of grotesque, vibrating, heated massage chair that is described in the books as being sort of the pinnacle of luxury, but really is just kind of a symbol for the cruelty and moral bankruptcy of the Duneverse, which is something that Frank Herbert was trying to get across. In the Dosadi experiment, another of the novels, bed dogs was another option. So you get a lovely bed that you can lie on that would, I guess, help ease you off to sleep.
Imagine having to clean the poo up in your house because your furniture's been running around the place defecating.
And what do you feed it?
Well, yeah, exactly. This person who wrote this book doesn't seem to think of the consequences of the things he makes up.
I guess he invites the reader to consider the consequences of such a morally bankrupt piece of technology.
But I think it was made clear in the episode that he knew nothing about science fiction or science at the start of it. Clearly, he knew nothing about it at the end.
Ah, the old lady at the beginning of the episode. Yeah, that was one of the researchers that worked with him. And it sort of was indicating that perhaps he wasn't quite so aware of the world that he was writing as he was going.
You really got the feeling that he lost track of a few things. Well, it's like, yeah. In the appendix.
We now need to face the big worm in the room.
Okay. I'm not taking my trousers down again.
Yeah, you were talking about relative sizes, weren't you, of the Duneverse?
Yeah, how many Frances was it? 70,000 Frances across the entire universe.
It didn't feel right at all, did it?
Well, it got me thinking. And how many Frances in the world?
One.
Yeah, I know that one.
how many Frances would it take to tile the world?
100.
That's not true. You just made that up.
I did, yes.
Okay, so say, how many times bigger is the Earth, the surface area of the Earth, to the surface area of France?
Oh, of the whole Earth. I was working on an inhabitable area.
Okay, we can do this very quickly. It's a very simple calculation.
I don't think you know who you're dealing with, Paul.
Okay, so first of all, the area of France is almost exactly 250,000 square miles.
It is.
And funnily enough, the radius of the Earth is almost 4,000 miles. So then the calculation is quite easy, isn't it? So the surface area of a sphere is 4 pi r squared.
Yep.
So 4,000 squared is...
what you're about to say.
4,000 squared is 16 million.
Exactly, yeah.
So 16 million times 4 is 64
Correct.
Million.
Absolutely.
And you multiply 64 million by pi 3 and a bit.
And what do you get?
200 million square miles.
There you have it.
And so, surprisingly, for the whole surface of the Earth, there you could fit 800 Frances in.
And this is my point.
Well, if you take 30% of 800, so that's 240, you can fit 240 Frances in the land area of the Earth.
Right. So this is where I was surprised by how few Frances made up a planet, which is really what we were talking about, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I've been endorsed by Paul Dursley and will definitely get a boost in my grade as a consequence.
No, not for this argument.
Oh, bum.
So that was Chair Dogs.
Now, Ryan, yes. Now you know how I felt throughout virtually all of this episode.
So, Ryan, where do you think the dunes that inspired Frank Herbert's Dune were? The original, actual Earth-based dunes that gave him the sort of inspiration?
I mean, I'll go with the Sahara.
Well, you would be wrong.
Right.
It is, in fact, the dunes of Oregon.
Wait, what?
In the 1950s, apparently, Frank Herbert was sent to a place called Florence in Oregon, where sand dunes were threatening to cover everything up and making everything basically unhelpfully sandy. And he was there for, I think it was a journalist, to view what the engineers and ecologists were doing to stop the sand in a plan to terraform, in inverted commas, the landscape. But I was just astonished to discover that I had assumed that he'd spent some of his life in the Middle East and consequently had come with all this sort of Islamic inspired language and culture. But no, Oregon was the start of all of this.
I refer you to the lady at the start.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
For the films, though, I would have to say that Oregon, perhaps shockingly, was not chosen to represent the desert planet. And that was in the Middle East. So, Ryan, I don't know if you're familiar with the land of Wadi Rum in Jordan.
Why?
Because it is frequently standing in for various other planets in various movies. So The Martian.
Oh, okay.
So Mars is frequently done in Wadi Rum, which is in Jordan in the Middle East. But also the open desert-y areas were filmed in a place called Liwa Desert in the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula in the United Arab Emirates.
There you go. Okay, so, but here's the thing, right? One of the deserts you didn't mention there, Pete, is the Gobi Desert in Mongolia. And I did a little bit of research about the Gobi Desert because I was still looking at creatures from the Juniverse. And it crossed my mind. I'm like, do sandworms really exist? Obviously not the 400 meter long ones. I think those would have been spotted by now.
We'd have noticed those for sure.
We probably would have done. But I did wonder whether or not there were any real life snakes or worms that sort of wriggled around and lived underneath the sand or in the sand. And the answer is no. But also, perhaps. Because in the Gobi Desert in Mongolia, there is a legendary worm which is said to live in the sand. It's known as Algurai Korkai, which means large intestine worm, and is more commonly known as the Mongolian death worm. Now, The Mongolian death worm is described as a vivid red worm, which is about 5 feet in length. And it's known not just for looking like a cow's intestine, but also because it's said to be lethal to humans and animals. Now, lethal how? Well, the death worm is capable of spitting venom up to 12 feet, which will kill anything that it touches on impact. Some accounts also say that along with the spitting venom, it can also electrocute people, a bit like an electric eel.
I have so many questions. One, is it real? Two, is it real? Three, who looked at it and their first thought was, of the many things I've seen in life, that looks like a cow's intestine.
Yeah.
And you said the word supposedly.
Well, yes, this is all supposedly because there is no concrete proof of the Mongolian death worm. At the moment, it's categorised as a legend or a cryptid. But that hasn't stopped a number of brave people setting out into the Gobi Desert to try and find it. The Soviet Union was said to be one of the first. They launched several expeditions to find it during the 1960s and 70s. More recently, a cryptozoologist called Ivan McCurl, he led several expeditions between 1990 and 2004, during which time he searched the desert and he interviewed local nomads. He collected their stories and their legends, but so far hasn't found any tangible evidence. In 2006 and 2009, there was an American TV show called Destination Truth that ventured into the Gobi to try and find the death worm, but they also failed to find it. And so, up until today, it remains something of a mystery.
You think of a program called Destination Truth, I think the answer is no.
Well, some say that the death worm originates from sightings of other creatures, real things like the venomous Pallas's cat snake or a legless lizard called the Mongolian racer.
Isn't a legless lizard a snake?
Yes, I was thinking.
No, it's a lizard without legs, obviously, hence the name.
That seems like a subtle difference to me.
Anyway, the rumours are persistent, particularly within the Mongolian culture. It is, in fact, taboo to speak about the Mongolian death worm when you are in the desert. Apparently, it draws the creature's attention to you. So if you find yourself in the Gobi Desert, don't say its name.
Doesn't exist.
I think of the things that are likely to kill me in the Gobi Desert, the hierarchy is packed with things that do exist. I'm probably not going to fall foul of the death worm, but my death is probably inevitable regardless. So, Ryan, we talked about spice, the spice that is a trippy chemical that enables people to do various things, see the future, steer interstellar spacecraft.
Prolongs life and stuff, doesn't it?
Yeah, it very much does, yes. And you might be wondering where 1960s author Frank Herbert got his ideas from. And it will shock you, Ryan, to learn that his own experiences with magic mushrooms or psilocybin have said to be major impact in his development of the concept of Dune. But more than that, he cultivated his own. There's a guy called Paul Stamets who wrote a book, Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. And he talks about Frank Herbert's methods of cultivation, actually. So he's actually talking about him as a mushroom cultivator. But he also goes on to say, Frank went on to tell me that much of the premise of Dune, the magic spice, brackets spores, that allowed the bending of space, brackets tripping, the giant sandworms, brackets maggots digesting mushrooms, brackets, the eyes of the Fremen, the cerulean blue of psilocybe mushrooms, the mysticism of the female spiritual warriors, the Bene Gesserits, inspired by tales of the Maria Sabina and the sacred mushroom cults of Mexico, all came from his perception of the fungal life cycle, and his imagination was stimulated through his experiences with the use of magic mushrooms. That blue point, I was struck by. I'm not familiar with blue mushrooms. I don't know if you are.
Wood bluets, they're very tasty. I found some once.
Ah, well, I looked up magic mushrooms and they're not actually blue normally. The magic mushrooms or the psilocybe mushroom are one of several species of mushroom that actually go blue when you cut or bruise them.
Is that what the psi bit of cybe is? Cyan?
I don't know, but I do know that it's this really vivid blue that nobody quite understands why these things go blue when they do, but it's a characteristic of the magic mushroom. So if you're wondering, is this mushroom magic? Cut it in half, and if it turns blue, maybe it is.
Well, also, of course, the field mushroom has a similar mushroom called the yellow stainer, which to all intents and purposes is the same, but mildly toxic. But you can tell it by, if you scratch the surface it goes yellow. So it's the same sort of idea.
Ah, so avoid the yellow ones, go for the blue ones. But hallucinogenics aren't just for people. I was also drawn to other animals that like to trip on various things, like reindeer will hoof up fly agaric mushrooms and get a trip on. Cats like to get stoned on catnip. Dolphins apparently will nibble on pufferfish to get a bit of a high going on. And there's something called loco weed in the plains of America that cows love it. Apparently they graze on it and then they go into a calm trance where they kind of just stare into the distance. Although that does sound like just what cows do anyway, so that may be a misnomer.
Hard to know when a cow is tripping or not.
Right, exactly. A mellow cow is just a normal cow, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, it's no surprise to discover that Frank Herbert was inspired by and a keen user of hallucinogenic substances, because let's face it, that's where you get your dog chairs from, isn't it?
All right, so the story of June features a young hero with a mysterious past who lives on a desert planet and joins a rebel force to fight against an evil galactic empire. Does that remind you of anything?
I wonder who he stole that from.
Yes. So, 12 years after Dune was published in 1965, George Lucas releases Star Wars. And immediately, there is some criticism about there being similarities between the two. In fact, the question of how much George Lucas had ripped off Dune was one that constantly kept getting asked of Frank Herbert. And in 1977, when Star Wars was first released, the Associated Press approached Herbert and asked him for his opinion. And in the article, he says that he hadn't seen Star Wars at that point yet, but he revealed that some other people had said to him that he should sue over some of the similarities. He said, and I quote, "I will try hard not to sue. I have no idea what book of mine it fits, but I suspect it may be Dune, because in that I had a princess called Aaliyah, and the movie has Princess Leia." But Lucas himself has continually declined, not denied, but declined to say whether Dune was actually an inspiration for Star Wars. He is quoted as saying that the two sci-fi epics are similar, but only in the sense that they both have deserts.
Which... No, I'm on George Lucas's side here, which is perhaps a first for me. Because you could as equally say Dune is Lawrence of Arabia in space.
You could indeed. In fact, Frank Herbert has maintained that the similarities between Dune and Star Wars, in quotes, didn't quite sit right with him. Most notably, there was a speech he gave in 1985 where he said, and I quote, "Lucas has never admitted that they copied a lot of Dune, and I'm not saying they did, I'm just saying that there are 16 points of identity between the book Dune and Star Wars, 16 times over one. The odds against that being a coincidence, well, there aren't that many stars in the universe." But he never did sue Lucas, but he did mock Star Wars in one of his books. So when he released his fifth Dune novel, Heretics of Dune, people were drawn to one particular passage which spoke about some minor characters which he had just introduced, which he described as a 3PO, which means such a person that surrounds themselves with cheap copies made from déclassé substances. Basically, that Star Wars is a cheap copy made with lesser parts.
I've been pro-Frank all through this, but on this matter, they are very different stories. The whole concept is quite different. There are points of similarity, but that's the nature of fiction.
He invented Chewbacca. No one had done Chewbacca before. And then, later, we get chair dogs. Who's stealing now? And so we have come to the end of the line. Peter, it is time to step into the dock and prepare to face the people's judge. Judge Dursley, are you ready to give your verdict?
If you insist.
Will the defendant please rise?
Is it worth it?
Probably not.
Can I just sit?
Your Honour, as usual, may we start proceedings by first asking for your verdict on factual content.
We've had this before with these fantasy things.
Well, there was some factual stuff in this.
I put facts in. I made facts happen.
Yes,
I'm afraid I have a problem with mindfulness.
This is not going to go well for you, Pete.
I believe it's great to take time out, you know, to stand back and think about it. But all of this labelling it mindfulness and all of this, I think you're just finding a label for something that's plainly obvious.
Right. Well, then may we have your grade for factual content?
E minus.
I didn't even know there was an E minus.
Okay. Well, we've started strong. Your Honour, may we have your verdict on entertainment value? Were you entertained by this episode?
No.
Then may I have your grade for entertainment value?
F plus.
F. Wow, that's a fail. Then, Your Honour, may we have your verdict on Dursley Factor?
Oh, come on!
Z minus.
Hit the Z! I'm reinventing the scoring system.
Oh, wow. Well, that may give you an indication of where this is going, Peter.
Yes.
And we are about to reach the final verdict. But before the judge passes his ruling, Peter, you have an opportunity to enter a plea. If you choose to do so, you probably should make that plea now.
Well, yes, I would like to make a plea, as a matter of fact. So, I think I did an excellent job of describing the universe, orienting you, bringing it to current and real things that happen in our world, and exploring philosophical ideas and religious notions, and to explore the joy of fiction, expand your mind to things that can be, but not necessarily are, in today's world.
Also, you had Dan Collins.
Also, Dan Collins, who not only gave us an excellent interview, but provided musical interludes for us to enjoy. So, if anything, you owe it to Dan to give us an A plus plus plus.
All right, Your Honour, the defendant stands before you. Have you reached a verdict?
Yes.
In which case, I would ask most respectfully for your ruling.
I just didn't get it. This whole thing just left me cold. I wanted to know less about it.
Right. Then may we have your final verdict?
You ungraded. I can't.
Wow.
I cannot grade it.
Yay! Wow. I'm above grading. This isn't. I've transcended grades, which is quite appropriate for the episode, actually.
I am stunned, Peter. We have finally hit a U grade. Well done, Peter. Okay, well, there you go. That was the show for this week.
Can we get back to normal next time?
Yeah, I think we're going to get back to normal. But in the meantime, if you would like to get in touch about any of the things that we've talked about on this episode, or just to say hello, you can reach out to us on social media through our website at hhepodcast.com or by email at PeteAndRyan@hhepodcast.spice.
Don't forget, this is just a cynical exercise in Pete and Ryan trying to tie in with something in the zeitgeist.
Yeah, and for the record, it never works. But we would love to hear from you, and you never know, you might end up featured on a future show.
That's right, and one way to definitely feature on a future episode is to rate and review the show on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Your recommendation there goes a long way to helping to bring the show to new listeners.
And social media-wise, if you're on Mastodon, Facebook, Instagram, X, find us at HHE Podcast. And if you subscribe to those, you'll get an alert every time we post any new things, trivia, tidbits, news, photos, new things, facts.
Evidence of the Mongolian death worm. But we will be back again soon with our next episode 87, Hotspots on the Sun during 1957 to 1975. But in the meantime, a huge thank you to the judge himself. Say thank you, Peter.
Thanks, judge.
Well, you have broken the mold.
Thanks, Paul.
My pleasure. Or not on this episode.
And that is it. I guess all that's left to say is
the spice must flow.
Now, I have a new year that I'm testing out in this wine.
Okay.
And my first bottle of it, I didn't think the 2002 was as good as the 2001.
So, sorry, the 2022 compared to the 2021.
I would say I would pick 2021 over 2022 any day of the week.
Is that because it had less COVID in it?
Yes, because that 2022 was where COVID really kicked off, as I recall. Although it was also the year of my super spreader cheese tour. So.
Your what?
The super spreader cheese tour.
He brought you some cheese back, as I recall.
I did.
From that cheese tour.
What? I never saw any.
You definitely did. You paid for it as well.
Well, I might have paid for it, but I never saw any cheese.
Definitely saw it.
Jay, there are also some questions of high art and high theme in Dune. It's made by a director who has a very highly artistic track record. In fact, are some of these pretensions well-founded?
Pretensions is a good word. I think when it comes to this movie, and when you think about what Richard and I think about it, I think I can understand why they call this Two Solitudes. I think this is probably the worst thing that's being released this Christmas. I really, really hated the film. In the movie, somebody talks about a device that is going to amplify the pain of the people who were put in it. For me, that's what the film did. It's kind of endless pretentiousness and a real obsession with bodies opening up and emitting various kinds of noxious fluids. I found it not only not fun to watch, but repulsive.
I take it you don't want to talk about this anymore.
I don't.